Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, conversations about sexual and domestic violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Senior Victim Advocate Griselda Gonzalez, Dr. Michelle Hand, Sexual Violence Researcher and Assistant Professor of Social Work at George Mason University College of Public Health, and Dr. Denise Hines, Elizabeth Shirley Enix Endowed Professor of Social Work, also at George Mason University College of Public Health. And we'll talk about sexual violence in marginalized communities. Griselda, Michelle, Denise, welcome to Unscripted, and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Thanks for the invite.
Before we start, I want to let our listeners know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. Too often, sexual violence is portrayed as an issue affecting pretty young white women only. But leaving marginalized communities, that's men, older adults, members of the LGBTQ plus community, and other minoritized individuals, leaving them out of the conversation does everyone a disservice. So why do we do it? When we talk about sexual violence, why do we omit some populations from the discussion? Michelle, I'm going to go to you.
Thank you for that thoughtful question, Kendra. I think there's a number of reasons that older adults are omitted from that discussion, primarily owing to ageism. So when we think about sexual violence and later, well, when we think about sexual violence, we don't think about older adults. We think about often about younger people, as you mentioned, usually white, cisgender. There's a perfect victim stereotype that's been going around that, you know, people have to be young, attractive, white, female, often attacked by a stranger. Sometimes the myth surrounds, you know, nighttime attacks or something, when typically people, they can be attacked by strangers, but they're often hurt by people they know. And we can be victimized across the lifespan. Older adults are also sexual beings. And I think we don't think about older adults being sexual and thinking that there's a need to be sexual in order to be victimized, even though we know that's not true of children.
Denise, you work with men and LGBTQ plus communities. Why do we leave them out of the discussion?
Well, I think it depends on the community itself. So with LGBTQ communities, I think we often think that they're in relationships with their gender equals. And so because there's an equalized relationship, we don't think that one can dominate the other sexually. I also think with men, one thing, the assumption is that if men are sexually assaulted, they're sexually assaulted by men. And we often think of that in the context of prison. And of course, that does happen. But we forget that sometimes, or we overlook that one of the main perpetrators of sexual violence against men is women. And I think we just have this idea that men are the sexual, they're the ones that initiate sex, and women are sort of the gatekeepers of sex. And we overlook the fact that women can try to initiate sex. And we have this stereotype that men are always sexually available and wanting sex at all times and wouldn't say no to a woman. And so it leaves out the fact that men can engage or be forced to engage in sexual relationships with women when they do not want to. And so there's a lot of stereotypes about sexuality that make people really reluctant to understand and believe that this can happen. And I think men also encounter a further issue that when they try to come forward and say, this woman sexually assaulted me, they're often met with this idea, oh, well, you're lucky, you know, especially if she's an attractive woman. You are lucky. I wish I was you. Mm-hmm. And so These are a lot of kind of stereotypes and barriers that men have to overcome if they're sexually assaulted.
Griselda, in my intro, I mentioned men and older adults in the LGBT plus community. Who did I leave out?
So I work with a lot of the immigrant population, and there's a lot of disclosed barriers within your conversations alone. There's been, you know, disclosures of shame, of fear of retaliation, whether it be by family members or the person who caused harm. There's also barriers in language and being able to fully express what has happened, details of the incidents, and being able to express exactly what the violence entailed. When they do report. And I say when they do report because there's also been a disclosure that there's fear of engaging with law enforcement, that there's a lot of concerns, especially for those who are undocumented, to be able to connect with law enforcement or with anybody in that field and disclose a crime, fear of retaliation from the system themselves. So there's been a lot of barriers within that community, but also one of the biggest ones, I think, has been the language barrier, being able to communicate effectively of what they've experienced.
Okay, so you just mentioned a something that I was going to talk about later, but we'll talk about it now. We know that across the spectrum of survivors, that's whatever age, whatever race, whatever sexuality, the whole gamut, people often don't report sexual violence. Why is that? I get the police, the law enforcement part, but are there other reasons that, in general, people don't report?
I think and a lot of people, particularly these under-recognized groups that we're talking about right now, is that they don't recognize necessarily that what happened to them is sexual assault because it doesn't match the stereotype that Michelle talked about at the very beginning. My work with college students years ago, I saw that was definitely the case. It was like, oh, but he's a friend of mine, or you know, those kinds of things. And they just think that maybe there was a misunderstanding, or maybe I did something that precipitated this issue, or precipitated the attack, or, you know, there's drinking involved, or, well, that's something that happens to women, and I'm a man, or I'm a gay man, or I'm a heterosexual man, or, you know, that because they don't fit the stereotype, it takes them a long time to figure out exactly what happened to them.
Yeah, I think adding to that, there's issues with, in later life, communication. So there are people living with aphasia who can't communicate what they've experienced or who live with dementia. There was one man I researched where I talked with a service provider about who I did some research with, and he was saying that his wife had experienced sexual violence. He witnessed it, and she was older. She was living with dementia, and then he was also living with dementia, and he'd forgotten it not long after seeing it. So there's issues with memory for survivors as well as for caregivers and loved ones who witness it. There's also this fear of not being believed, especially in later life, because there is this, again, ideal stereotype of who makes a good victim, essentially. And I think that there's also, my research has shown that there's generational concerns of not wanting to air dirty laundry and not feeling like, you know, people can talk to younger folks.
And just adding to that, there's potentially fear of not being believed because they don't have that contingent proof that it occurred. There's a lack of education, sometimes an understanding, like Denise mentioned, of what they've actually experienced, and believing that there's no proof of a sexual assault. However, they may have experienced other types of sexual violence. And so believing that that reporting may not take them, you know, as far as they would like as well, not being believed, not having that proof in combination is one of the reasons why some folks don't report. Additionally, there's shame or there's guilt of what they've experienced.
And I also know, adding to that and my research with the LGBTQ community. And from what I've seen in the immigrant community as well, and some minoritized individuals, is this a very strong reluctance and justified reluctance of not wanting to report members of their own community to avoid further stigmatizing an already stigmatized community. Mm-hmm. So they'd rather just suffer in silence than risk that their community will be further marginalized, or that members of their community would be subject to more bias and stereotypes and so forth.
Yeah, you find that with older adults too. They don't want to report their caregivers, who are often unpaid family members, because they're relying on those caregivers for care and they're worried about their needs being met. But also they don't want to, in many cases, report their adult children or their spouses. And adding to that, there's fear of retaliation, particularly in assisted living facilities, when people are relying on care from other people and they're not sure if their needs are going to be addressed.
Just adding to that, the trauma that they've experienced can be, you know, one of the reasons why they don't report. Sometimes dealing with having to relive or retell their story is traumatizing to folks, and they rather avoid having to have those conversations.
What about the taboo that having, that talking, just talking about sex, we use it to sell everything from soda to cars to, you know, I don't know, exercise machines. But there's a taboo in this country about talking about sex. I get that sexual violence is really not sex, it's power and control. But what part does that play in people not disclosing?
From the service providers I've talked with who serve older adults, a lot of them say that older people don't tend to want to talk about sex as it is, just because generationally they haven't. You know, it's becoming something that we talk about more often in social media now today, and you see more of a buzz about sex in general and then about sexual violence. But a lot of the service providers I've talked with have said, you know, older adults don't want to talk about sex, let alone sexual violence, right? These things just aren't discussed. You don't talk about personal issues, let alone with people who aren't even in your age group and wouldn't understand.
And just adding to that, there's a vulnerability piece that a lot of folks have reported that we don't talk about that because that's private, or because that means I'm exposing my dirty laundry or my inside scoop to their private life that may not be ready to share.
And my experience of working with college students, like I said, is even though they are the younger generation and supposedly maybe more comfortable than older generations in talking about sex, they're really not. When you try to ask them, I've served on sexual assault judicial boards in college populations and in colleges and universities, and they're not very good at talking about the body parts involved and the acts that occurred. It makes them very nervous and very shy. So I don't know that we've really overcome the population's ability to talk about sex.
Okay. When I was prepping for this conversation, I realized that the research that both of you do, Michelle and Denise, is sort of not really done much. Like, you guys are the only people doing this work. Why aren't we studying this more?
Unfortunately, there's still a great deal of ageism among researchers themselves. So, we still have researchers, scholars who are publishing in articles calling older adults elderly, right? And promoting age-based stereotypes that just aren't accurate. So we have this issue. I admit, one of the reasons I got into this research is because I didn't think about older adults, right? When I was thinking about sexual violence, I started out in sex trafficking research and didn't realize that older adults could be victimized. And so I think that a big problem is we can't begin to research and address what we're not even talking about as a society. Mm-hmm. So these people are largely hidden or invisible victims.
Yeah, in thinking about this, Adding on to what we said earlier, I think the researchers are subject to a lot of the same stereotypes. I think there is much more acknowledgement among researchers that people are sexually assaulted by people that they know. I think researchers are very clear on that. But then acknowledging the full range of potential victims, there's been a barrier there as well. And I think the stereotypes, the unaddressed biases that people in the field have are still driving who gets the attention.
Yeah. Griselda, you and I talked a few weeks ago about this topic, and you mentioned a population that I hadn't even thought about that we don't service well, and that's dating relationships. We don't really have we're starting to get maybe the laws, the language to deal with people who are sexually violated by someone they're dating, not married to, not in an official partnership with.
Correct. Yeah. So the relationships and dating are, I want to say, sometimes tricky because there's, such a movement with the online dating and the purpose of meeting and whatnot. And again, just, falling into that shame or guilt of like, I didn't have a relationship with this person. And it may come off wrong to disclose and what resources may be available to them because of that relationship, or thinking that they may not meet the criteria or eligibility for support, and also, not being believed when they want to open up to law enforcement. There's a lot of work that we are trying to focus on when it comes to those dating relationships or those other relationships that are not as popular, not as promoted, I want to say, in a way. When just going back to something that Michelle mentioned about the perfect victim, it's a lot of folks have reported, I don't fit that criteria. That's not what's promoted on either social media or the news as to what types of help is available. And so in hindsight, when folks are looking at the cases that are receiving the attention, they don't fit that mold. They don't fit that ideal. And they believe that maybe their situation would not be, heard, or would not be something that anybody pays attention to or thinks of.
I thought we had solved this when we admitted that there was date rape, but I guess I'm wrong.
Yeah, that culture, there's a lot of stigma behind the date rape, but it's also, promoting the idea of like, well, this is what happens, and vulnerable, and they took over physically, and all of these other components need to be present. And so when those components are not present, a lot of folks are questioning, did it happen? Is it applicable to me? Do I say something? And so those are a lot of questions, and that someone is making themselves, also potentially feel guilt of what speaking up. And so there's a lot of work to be done still.
We're going to take a quick pause here to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. What are the survivors that you work with and that you research say that they need from those of us working in the field to support them, to provide resources? What do they say they need? What do they say they want?
They want to be believed. That is a huge one. From the folks that I've worked with, they want to be believed. There's been reports of, having the courage of speaking to law enforcement, and the feedback that they get during reporting is more of like, are you sure this happened? There's a lot of questioning, a lot of inquisition that makes survivors question, why did I even speak up? They're not going to believe me. And that, I think, has been the biggest one amongst my, the folks that I've worked with.
Michelle, what about you?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. First and foremost, they want to be believed. They don't want to be judged. They want to be kept safe. That's another big important piece. So there was one woman who had been harmed several times by someone who was living with her. And she's like, when are you guys going to get this person out of my house? And she was eventually found on the ground unconscious because it didn't happen soon enough, right? And then prosecution was delayed, you know, another 2 years. So there's this time that's spent in the court system also that I've been learning in recent collaborative research that's been really difficult for victims and survivors, or however they choose to identify, that they would like a faster process, and they would like more of a voice in determining what happens to the people who hurt them, right? So like for everyone, it's not always prosecution, right? Sometimes they're like, I just want this person to get the help they need and to stay away from me, but I don't want them behind bars.
And to add to that, I definitely see a lot of need for validation. And I also see a need to have assurances that they won't be blamed for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what did you do? What did you do that contributed to it? Those kinds of questions. So I think that is very, very important. Just going back to the basics of general helping people, that I think everyone in this field is trained in making sure. I know in the LGBTQ community too, what some of our studies showed that they were concerned about going forward and saying, this person victimized me, and that the person that they were seeking help from needed more information about the fact that this was, maybe a woman sexually assaulting a woman or a man sexually assaulting a man, and focusing first on the fact that, oh, I didn't know you were gay, or I didn't know you were trans, and having to deal with that first rather than the trauma that they experienced. They don't want to have to go through that. And so we are finding that in many of these communities that aren't usually acknowledged as potential victims of sexual violence, that they're looking for services that they know will just understand, so that they don't have to go through the process of explaining who they are first before they can get to the trauma itself.
And it sounds like across the board, we need better education, information, and awareness for victims, whatever stripe they are, but particularly for marginalized communities.
I wanted to add another thing that has been requested by folks that I worked with was just showing that respect of the disclosure and being able to access language services to be able to report or disclose their situation without having to cut back on any pieces or having to shorten the version, and be able to fully express what it is that has occurred or how they feel about certain situation. There's been, some feedback stating that when a language interpreter is used and they're asked to use short sentences, there's times where they have shortened or modified what they've disclosed, and it doesn't necessarily reflect everything that they would love to say in a disclosure. So I think that's a huge one from folks who have English as a language, second language.
What are some other challenges that we face when we're supporting marginalized communities?
I think there's a real problem, well, a need, I should say, for further interagency and interdisciplinary collaboration. So one hand often doesn't know what the other hand's doing. Survivors also have to retell their stories over and over again to several different professionals. And this can be re-traumatizing. This is true of caregivers as well, who have witnessed the people they love being sexually abused. So I think there's a real need for further collaboration and for further funding, right? So we know that most people who survive trauma, there is a need for an exploration of veteran trauma. We're still not doing enough, but most people who survive trauma are people who are civilians, right? It's non-combat related trauma, yet most of the funding for research goes to combat related trauma. So when we think about what's needed to respond to survivors after they've experienced sexual violence and trauma, we need further research. We need more training in particular for community members and for service providers, with greater representation. So, I was talking with an APS worker who said, I've never received a training on sexual violence in my life. And she's an adult protective services worker, right? And she said, typically people come in and they provide sexual violence trainings on younger populations, and that's who they work with. And then they just extrapolate what they've learned from those younger populations and try to apply it to older adults, and that doesn't really work. So I still think that there's this nothing about us without us need in terms of the resources as well, making sure that we're asking survivors what they want and we're including older voices and diverse voices, the people who are being impacted themselves in the services that are being delivered to them and the trainings that inform the service providers who work with them.
Who else should we include at the table that we want to educate, inform, raise awareness? Who else should be brought to this table?
I think a key population is medical providers. Of the services that are available to sexual violence victims, those are usually services that you have to seek out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But medical providers typically see many of these communities on a regular basis for other issues, and are in a key position to be able to detect sexual violence victimization among their patients. I know we put a lot on doctors, but they are a key community in at least being able to detect and refer to people who can help. So they really are at the forefront of folks that we need to educate.
I just want to add as well that the survivor voices that we don't typically see could be included here, because there's folks that may be more reluctant to participate because of the stereotype of the ideal victim not fitting into it. But we actually need those voices of the marginalized communities to be able to have those discussions and elevate their concerns, elevate their barriers that they are facing, and be able to make those changes, you know, through policy and procedures, and be able to have their stories and their communicated to others' systems. Law enforcement as well needs to be at the table to be able to understand, you know, and hopefully put in practice a little bit more trauma-informed services and help fight those barriers and those stigmas that folks are experiencing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Survivors first. Also, yes, healthcare providers, nurses, people who interface with survivors regularly or at-risk individuals, community faith leaders, so clergy is huge, domestic and sexual violence service providers, of course, elder care service providers, particularly in memory care units, adult day services, APS, as I've heard from APS workers that they're not getting enough training, caregivers, so that's, you know, paid and unpaid caregivers, as well as the general population. You know, in general, we need to talk more about this and get the information out to people. I also have talked with survivor-facing professionals in the criminal legal system who need more training on how to respond to survivors once they have experienced sexual violence, particularly in later life.
What has surprised you while doing this work and this research? I'm going to start with you, Denise. What has surprised you while doing this work?
That's an excellent question. I don't know that much has surprised me. But I think one of the things that has concerned me the most is just how extra silent these under-recognized victims are. And so it becomes this perpetuating cycle, right? So we don't, we have this stereotype of what a victim of sexual violence is.
Mm-hmm.
And because they don't fit the stereotype, we don't hear about it. And so we maintain that stereotype. And so this intractability of the stereotype, even though we as researchers and service providers see that the stereotype is not true, is very difficult to break.
Michelle, what surprised you?
I'd say I was surprised back in 2015-ish when I started researching this, just how much wasn't known about the needs of older survivors and the fact that this does happen in later life. I thought it was just me who was being ageist, and it turns out that there's a need for awareness that's much greater than I realized. And now in 2026, I'm also surprised that there's still so much work to do. And I've been surprised by how many people who work with older adults and with sexual violence survivors are surprised themselves to know that older adults can be sexually abused. That surprised me, particularly when you think about, you know, folks who work with older adults don't tend to be ageist. And I guess I always thought of the needs stemming from ageism, but it moves beyond that.
Griselda, what surprised you doing this work?
I want to add to that last comment that Michelle mentioned, surprised of when we do get reports from folks who are older, that the resources may not necessarily be applicable to their situation, that there's more limitation of options in terms of services that could be applicable to their situation. That I think has been one of the biggest concerns, the resources that are available to those who are not, do not fit the typical, you know, stereotype, the do not need the shelter, or that do not need, certain basic needs, but need additional support, and the resources there are limited. We've had a lot of folks who have mentioned, you know, well, what else is out there? Mm-hmm. And I always ask myself, that is such a good question. What else is out there? And that prompts us to, you know, elevate our concerns, up the ladder and say, well, what else can we use to be able to help folks that don't necessarily, fit that stereotype, or that don't necessarily have the need for the resources that we currently, have available. So it's one of those questions and one of those concerns where, you know, we elevate and we continue, but because it doesn't come around as often, I feel like sometimes falls through the cracks. As to what we'll put a pin on it, or yes, we should work on it. There's recognition that there's a need for it, but there hasn't been a lot of follow up with those questions.
Okay, we could talk about this all day, but I'm going to get your final thoughts and what we want to make sure the audience takes away from this discussion. I don't want all of you to answer. So Michelle, I'm going to go to you first.
Thank you for that. I would say, first, going back to something I said earlier, I don't believe that we can begin to prevent or address anything we aren't talking about, right? So we need to start talking about this and speaking up when we hear people make ageist or prejudiced remarks. We know that, you know, any form of ageism, sexism, and heterosexism, any form of prejudice actually is correlated with other prejudice, and that's also correlated with a greater endorsement of violence. So by speaking up and challenging stereotypes and prejudice remarks, we're actually helping to address violence. Also, I think we need more intergenerational exposure, some more grand friends in our lives, right? So I work with a number of college students who say they don't feel comfortable talking with their grandparents. And research has shown that when we talk with people who don't look like us or don't have the same backgrounds, it actually helps us to become less prejudiced. And I'd also say that the good news in all of this is that we all have a role to play. So we can continue to learn about what we can do to help prevent and address sexual violence across the lifespan.
Denise?
Well, I don't know if I can top that, but I do think we need to have more public education. We need to keep trying to bust the stereotypes about what sexual violence victimization is. We need to talk about how everybody can be a perpetrator. Everybody can be a victim. That there is no one way that this manifests. And I think we need to encourage people to check their own biases, to examine their biases, and to understand how that impacts how they are treating people who are potentially victims in their own circles. And so one thing I've noticed from doing this kind of research is that sometimes I might be the only person they've ever told, because they know that they will be believed and they'll be validated, which is something that they're not sure that they can get anywhere else. And so I think that that's very important, is that you have to show that you are someone who will believe whoever it is who comes to you with that issue.
And Griselda, you get the final word.
From our end, I think it's continuing to reassess how we can improve our services, how we can take up space in places to have these important conversations, and continue to equip ourselves and with the tools needed to be able to help those who are potentially falling through the cracks. And being part of these conversations are so important, because it does help us understand as well, you know, other perspectives, other encounters, and be able to elevate that and adjust our education, promote, you know, that awareness in the community with the network that we have, and be able to take into account the voices that have not been heard and give them a space to be able to relate everything that that could improve.
Okay. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Griselda, Michelle, and Denise for joining us and sharing their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.